Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankfort welcoming you to the December 15th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. This, as you probably realize, is the third Wednesday of December, when you would expect to hear Joy LeClaire, who brings you forthright radio on the first and third Wednesdays. Lately, you may have heard both the leaders of Israel and of the American Jewish community complain about a campaign of, quote, delegitimization, unquote, being waged against the state of Israel by critics of its ongoing occupation and oppression of the Palestinians. This is Israel's and its American supporters' strategy to counter the increasing effectiveness of another campaign initiated by Palestinian civil society and not by the Palestinian Authority, that calls for human rights activists around the world to join the boycott, divestment, and sanction campaign, better known as BDS, that targets Israel. There are currently two levels of BDS, the one originating in occupied Palestine and which is gaining support worldwide, is based on the campaign that was waged against the apartheid regime in South Africa and targets all companies that do business or have investments in Israel, as well as all Israeli institutions, cultural as well as academic. The other, that is predominantly in the United States, focuses on those businesses that have offices or factories in the West Bank who are directly involved in Israel's maintaining its occupation and settlement policies, such as Caterpillar, which manufactures the bulldozers that are used to destroy Palestinian homes. At the moment, there's a statewide effort in California to get the required 434,000 signatures of registered voters to put what is called the Israeli Divestment Act on next June's ballot. If passed, it would require the two massive California employee pension funds, CalPERS and STERS, to divest some companies that, quote, do business related to the construction or maintenance of Israeli settlements, including those in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, or that provide military services and supplies to Israel, end quote. The deadline for signatures is January 31st, 2011. Today, at about 20 minutes past the hour, I'm going to be speaking with Omar Baghouti, one of the founding members of the Palestinian Civil Society Boycott Campaign, and discuss with him how it has grown among international unions, church groups, and even governments. I will also get his response to criticism that has been made of BDS by certain critics of Israeli policy. And I'll be opening the phones for your calls and comments the last 15 minutes of the program. And I'm also pleased to tell you that next week, on my usual fourth Wednesday, I'll be once again interviewing Gareth Porter of Interpress Service. This time we'll be discussing the implications of the cables released by WikiLeaks, particularly as they relate to a potential attack on Iran, as well as some of the conspiracy theories that are currently floating around the internet that WikiLeaks is either a Mossad or CIA operation. My opinion? Those who have made such allegations have not taken the time to read the cables and have relied mainly on the news media for their opinions. So far, they have not provided a shred of evidence to back any claim that WikiLeaks and Julian Assange are anything other than what they appear to be. You will all remember the hullabaloo when the New York Times, which received the cables from the Guardian of London, not from WikiLeaks, reported that the heads of the oil-producing states in the Persian Gulf, led by King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, had privately told U.S. officials that they were all in favor of a U.S. attack on Iran, with Abdullah referring to the Iranian president Ahmadinejad as a snake whose head should be cut off, and the Emir of Bahrain comparing Ahmadinejad to Hitler. One might conclude that they were only saying what they thought that U.S. officials wanted to hear, and had they taken a contrary position that showed any sympathy with Iran, it would have been transmitted back to Washington, where a resolution denouncing the regime would be drafted by AIPAC and on the floor of Congress the next day. There should be no doubt, however, that quite apart from their concerns about Iran's nuclear program, these Arab dictators, all Sunnis, do harbor deep resentments against their Shia Iranian neighbors, which have deepened by the coming to power of the Shia in what has for centuries been Sunni-ruled Mesopotamia, what is now called Iraq. What I believe is much more significant is what was contained in a newly released cable that was briefly mentioned on Democracy Now! Yesterday, but hasn't received the same coverage here as did the statements of the Arab despots. This one revealed that Australian intelligence agencies feared that Israel may attack Iran and that such attack could set off a nuclear war in the Middle East. That was the Australian newspaper The Age reported on Monday. The report, based on cables released by WikiLeaks and provided exclusively to The Age, said that Australian intelligence believed that Iran's nuclear program was intended for deterrence and that viewing Iran as a rogue state would be a mistake. According to The Age, the cable sent from the U.S. Embassy in Canberra noted that, quote, the AICs, those Australian intelligence communities, leading concerns with respect to Iran's nuclear ambitions center on understanding the time frame of a possible weapons capability and working with the United States to prevent Israel from independently launching uncoordinated military attacks against Iran, unquote. Now, these are English-speaking Aussies, longtime close allies of Uncle Sam, telling us that. Wouldn't you think that might make some headlines, let alone be reported? Well, it was, as far as I can tell, only by the Christian Science Monitor and online. Meanwhile, their countryman Julian Assange remains in a British prison. He was given bail, but he remains in prison because the Swedish government has objected to that. You've probably heard or read by now that PayPal, Visa, and MasterCard have refused to accept any more donations for WikiLeaks, and that in turn their websites were hacked by WikiLeaks supporters, and perhaps it was deserved for reasons other than what the hackers had in mind. It turns out that Visa, MasterCard, and PayPal all accept donations to be made to Jewish and Christian organizations registered in the U.S. that are funding illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank, in defiance of U.S. policy as well as international law. It appears at least one of the major credit cards also enables donations to an extremist Jewish group that has placed a bounty on the lives of Palestinians. PayPal did back away from its initial claim that the State Department told it that WikiLeaks had broken the law after that claim was discredited. It's the third time PayPal has suspended payment services for WikiLeaks. Well, speaking of illegal settlements, Washington's, quote, Washington's decision that it will no longer attempt to persuade the Israelis to impose a new moratorium on settlement construction in order to restart peace negotiations is an abject and shocking mission of failure. Everyone knew that the Americans had serious difficulties trying to persuade the Israelis to concede on this vital issue, but there was wide belief that an ingenious diplomatic formula could be devised to enable talks to go ahead. No one imagined that President Barack Obama would simply capitulate to the Israelis. This is what has happened, end quote. That was from an editorial in the English-language Arab News, but something similar could be found in editorial pages and in op-ed columns all around the world. After President Obama announced that he was picking up the few marbles he had left after dealing with the Israelis and was going home. The key phrase that issued from the lips of both President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was something we have heard before and is at least half true. The quote is, "We can't want peace more than the parties themselves," end quote. It was first said by James Baker, the elder George Bush's Secretary of State back in 1991, and was repeated by President Bill Clinton, by Bush Jr., by now by Hillary Clinton and the President. And as far as the Israelis go, they are right. They have no need nor desire for recognition for negotiations, a point they seem to have made very clear. Their economy is doing just fine, and there is nothing to stop them from continuing to expand their current settlements while looking the other way while Jewish settlers build new ones. There are some signs, however, that the European Union, which had long ago abdicated the job of resolving the Israel-Palestine conflict to the U.S., may now be having second thoughts. Last week, the Israeli press, unlike its U.S. counterparts, reported that 26 former European leaders who held power during the past decade sent a 7-page letter on the subject to Catherine Ashton, the current foreign policy chief of the EU, in advance of a meeting of EU foreign ministers meeting in Brussels this past Monday, which called for harsh measures against Israel in response to its settlement policy and refusal to abide by international law. Among those signing the letter were former European High Representative for Foreign and Security Policy, Javier Solana, former German President Richard von Weizsäcker, former German Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, former Spanish Prime Minister Felipe González, former President of the EU Commission and Italian Prime Minister Romano Prodi, former Irish President Mary Robinson, former EU Commissioner, EU Commissioner Chris Patten, and former EU Commissioner Benita Ferrero-Waldner. The sharply worded document, drawn up at a meeting in London in mid-November, adds to a decision by the governments of Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay to recognize a Palestinian state within the 1967 borders, which has infuriated Washington as much as it has Tel Aviv, and the U.S. Congress, which is today going to vote on a resolution condemning the declaration of a Palestinian state. In addition, the European Council has decided to support the Palestinian Authority's decision to establish an independent state as a way of putting an end to the Israeli occupation. Coming on the heels of the Obama administration's admitted failure to get Netanyahu to extend the freeze on settlement construction for 90 days, despite offering Israel an unprecedented package of bribes, the former European leaders noted the key American figures had told them that the best way to help Obama in his efforts to promote peace was to come up with a policy that contradicts U.S. positions and comes at a cost to Israel. In the letter, the former European Union leaders proposed that the EU announce that it will not accept any unilateral changes to the 1967 border that Israel carried out against international law, and that the Palestinian state would cover an area the same size as the area Israel occupied in 1967. This would also include the establishment of its capital, East Jerusalem, something that the current Israeli government seems determined to prevent. And that information all comes from the Israeli press. Closer to home, there was an article in Monday's New York Times that reported there was an estimated 48,000 homeless in Los Angeles, 6,000 of them military veterans. This story comes to mind a few days after the Los Angeles Jewish Journal reported that the Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces, a tax-exempt group in the United States, held its annual fundraising dinner at the Century Plaza Hotel in Beverly Hills with the billionaire communications mogul, Egyptian-born Israeli-American Haim Saban playing host. The event raised just under $9 million, $8,750,000 to be precise, topping by more than $3 million the amount raised at a similar dinner last year, all of which will go to benefit veterans of the Israeli army, while thousands of U.S. vets from Iraq and Afghanistan, many with PTSD, are left to wander homeless in the city, our city streets. Saban himself donated $2.5 million of that amount. This amount raised in Beverly Hills, however, will surely be topped by a similar dinner, which will be held in New York, where last year they raised $20 million for the troops, the Israeli troops, that is. All in all, Saban, the leading individual donor to the Democratic Party, has donated $16 million to the Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces, all of which has been tax-exempt. It was no coincidence that two nights later, Saban was in Washington hosting Hillary Clinton at the Saban Center at the formerly independent Brookings Institution, which lost its independence when Saban endowed the institution with a $12.3 million donation. That, coincidentally, is the exact amount he donated to the Democratic Party in 2002, $7 million of which went to build the party's new Washington headquarters. After having been introduced by Saban, our Secretary of State began her talk saying, quote, "I appreciate the friendship that you," that is Haim, "and Cheryl," his wife, "have given to me and to my family. You've been friends for many years, and certainly as anyone who knows Haim understands, as an entrepreneur, a philanthropist, he is unparalleled, but also as a champion for peace. He represents in many ways in the best qualities of both Israel and America. He's generous, he's irrepressible, and he's absolutely unstoppable. And he has dedicated his energy and support to so many important causes and helped so many people. But he has probably no deeper passion than the one we are discussing tonight, strengthening U.S.-Israeli relations and securing a just and lasting peace in the Middle East," end quote, Hillary Clinton. I should add that he has also contributed $10 million to the Bill Clinton Library. Isn't it time they took down those for sale signs in the White House and Congress? Well, my guest today, Omar Barghouti, is an independent Palestinian researcher, commentator, and human rights activist, and a founder and leader of the Campaign for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, which has been launched by Palestinian civil society to force Israel to uphold international law and universal human rights. He is also a founding member of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, PACB. I had the pleasure of meeting and hearing Omar speak last April at a conference in San Anselmo. I reached him this morning in occupied Palestine, where it's evening. Welcome, Omar Baghouti, to Takes on the World.
Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I'm very happy to have you with us. Before we get into our discussion on the boycott, sanctions, and investment movement, I'd like to get your thoughts on the shutting down of the latest chapter in what seems to be the annual peace process charade.
Well, I've called them before negations rather than negotiations because I see them, as negating the reference to international law and to basic human rights, negating Palestinian rights, and negating our very right to have rights. So I really don't think that any hope can be gotten out of this charade indeed. So the last phase is continuing the hoax, continuing to sell empty hope to powerless bureaucrats that really have no mandate. And I'm referring here to the so-called Palestinian negotiating team. None of them has any democratic mandate to speak on behalf of the Palestinians, to represent us. So even if they sign any agreement that gives away our basic rights, it will not be worth the ink it was written in. So the U.S. is really not doing anything substantive to reach any so-called peace, because it's by definition peace devoid of justice and devoid of rights. It cannot be sustained. It is immoral. And Palestinians will never, ever accept it. So it's just perpetuating the bloody colonial conflict and giving Israel more time to cement its hold on more land with less Palestinians.
Well, it's interesting that Mahmoud Abbas's presidential term expired a couple of years ago, and it was extended for a year, which that extension ended last January, and yet America and the world seems to maintain this fiction that he is still the president of the Palestinian Authority.
Exactly. He has no mandate, as I said, so he does not speak on our behalf.
And also at the same time, Israel has been passing laws that even restrict even further what limited rights Palestinians had in the first place, and the Palestinians, let's say, inside Israel.
Yes, absolutely. I think Israeli apartheid, and I'll explain that term a bit later in the context of Israel, is becoming much more explicit, much more open to the world to see. Israel always had a very smart system of apartheid where it hid its racist, institutionalized laws under the guise of democracy and the right of the indigenous Palestinians to vote and so on. Now it's shedding that facade of democracy, and it's appearing more and more for what it is, through apartheid. And the reason why we use this term is not to smear Israel. Apartheid does not mean that Israel is similar or identical to South Africa, although there are many similarities, there are also many differences. When we term Israel's system as constituting apartheid, among other things, settler colonialism, obviously, we're just saying that part of Israel's regime of oppression against the Palestinians, in particular Palestinian citizens of Israel, conforms to the very definition of apartheid in the UN, the UN Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid. The Rome Statute and the International Criminal Court define apartheid. So it's an internationally defined crime that fits the bill quite well in Israel. Israel has tens of laws, at least 20, that are perfectly racist against the indigenous Palestinians, and openly racist, actually, but quite hidden. So yes, Palestinian citizens of Israel have the right to vote as long as they accept Israel as a racist state. They cannot challenge the very nature of Israel as a racist, exclusivist, so-called Jewish state. So long as they agree with this racist definition of the state, then they can vote, then they can run for the Israeli parliament or Knesset. But now Israel is adopting more racist laws. A few years ago it adopted the marriage law, which it keeps renewing, which says basically that Palestinians in Israel cannot get married to Palestinians in the occupied West Bank or Gaza. officially they can get married, but they cannot meet. Palestinians in Israel cannot enter the West Bank and Gaza legally, and Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza cannot enter Israel legally to live with their spouses. So this is one of the racist laws that came early on. Now Israel is passing more laws about loyalty and so on, adopted by the government, not yet by the Knesset, but increasingly Israel is adopting laws that many Israeli liberals are calling fascist. This term fascism is flying in the air in the mainstream media. We read it every few days now. Some journalists, some academics, some artists in Israel are calling these laws racist and fascist.
Well, it certainly is Israel giving a collective finger to the opinions of the world, not just to the Palestinians. It would seem that this would give further impetus to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement.
Sorry, I couldn't hear it very well. There was a problem on the line. Can you repeat that, Jeff?
Yeah, I would say that this situation and the collapse of the charade of peace talks, the bombing, the war on Gaza, the attack on the Mavi Marmara, all this seems would be an impetus to the movement to boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, which is similar to the one that was waged against South Africa, no?
Yes, absolutely. Although the BDS movement officially started in 2005, so it's only 5 years old, it has achieved quite a lot in reaching mainstream organizations, trade unions, church groups, Jewish groups, and so on, in the West in particular, not to mention India, South Africa, Brazil, Argentina, and so on. But after the Gaza massacre, after Israel's aggression against Gaza end of 2008, early 2009, and in particular after the flotilla attack, Israel was exposed to the world. The Goldstone Report helped a lot in that, and now the racist laws that Israel is passing, the loyalty law and so on, are certainly giving a lot of impetus to the already very fast-growing BDS movement. And I've said this before, when we started BDS in 2005, we just culminated 100 years of Palestinian civil and popular resistance against Israeli settler Zionism and then Israeli settler colonialism. But we had no expectations that in 5 years, from 2005 to 2010, we will get to this point. This has gone well beyond our most optimistic expectations. And part of the credit goes to the far-right Israeli government. Netanyahu and Lieberman have done everything possible to expose Israel for what it is, as a regime of occupation, colonialism, and apartheid.
Well, obviously, the movement has frightened both Israel and supporters in America. I mentioned earlier in the program, before I called you, that their strategy to counter it and that they're focused on this. They're claiming there is a campaign, without mentioning BDS, there's a campaign of delegitimization being waged against Israel. And this is obviously a public relations plan strategy which they've centered on both in Israel and in the United States, where they're constantly making speeches and writing op-ed pieces about this without actually usually even mentioning the BDS movement. So obviously there is a sense in Israel and among its supporters in the United States that the BDS movement is gaining ground.
Well, the highest authority in Israel, the Prime Minister, Netanyahu himself, called the boycott against Israel not just a delegitimization attempt, he called it a strategic threat. And he said that unless dealt with, it can become an existential threat. This is talk in the Israeli government, in the Knesset, in the elite, academic and intellectual elite in Israel. Now they're talking about the boycott as a possible existential threat. Yes, in the U.S., they're raising the specter of this so-called delegitimization of Israel slogan, and I find it quite primitive, to be honest, and I hate to use this word, but it is quite primitive. I think the Israel and the Zionist movement have largely failed to effectively combat the rising BDS movement. There are many reasons for this. The most important is that there's a near Palestinian consensus behind the BDS movement. And the second is that it's based on international law and basic human rights. third, it's completely anti-racism. So it's opposed to anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, all forms of racism. And we have Israeli partners, growing number of Israeli partners, Boycott from Within, the Coalition of Women for Peace, Hope Prophets, and so on, who are supporting BDS and doing a great work in supporting BDS. So it's not really flying, this accusation. Now, this delegitimization point I want to comment on, it's not effective at all, I think, but it's worth commenting on regardless. You know, the 0.1% that may be convinced with this argument, it's worth for them to listen to this. In no other case of boycott has anyone raised the specter of delegitimization. The boycott called against apartheid South Africa was not considered a delegitimization of the existence of whites in South Africa. It was a delegitimization of South African apartheid. Similarly, the boycott against Nazi Germany was not against Germans or Europeans or whites or Christians. It was a delegitimization of the Nazi regime, of genocide, of racism that the Nazis stood for. And I can go on and on. Even more recently, the divestment campaigns and boycotts against Sudan because of its human rights, mass human rights violations in Darfur, and many of them run by Zionist groups, quite cynically, in fact, and hypocritically, it's not a delegitimization of Arabs or Muslims or Africans. It's a protest against, supposedly, at least it's supposed to be a protest against Sudan's human rights violations. So only when it comes to Israel, this hypocrisy shows its face. Why is protesting Israel's apartheid, occupation, and settler colonialism a delegitimization? What is it a delegitimization of? The BDS movement, yes, delegitimizes Israel's oppression, its racism, its colonial rule, and its denial of Palestinian refugees the right to return and to receive reparations. That's what we are delegitimizing.
And all of that is incorporated in international law. In Resolution 194, which Israel agreed to accept as a way of being accepted as a state in the United Nations. Israel had initially agreed to accept the UN resolution, but then denied, refused to do it subsequently, and has made that a principal point.
And until the early 90s, the U.S. successive U.S. governments have also voted every single year to accept Resolution 194, which calls on the right of return for refugees and reparations. So it's absolutely stipulated in international law, yes.
One of the things that has arisen around the boycott, began as a cultural academic boycott, and this has created some controversy here in the United States because people say, well, you should separate art from politics, and the academy should be free to interchange. And so, what role does the Israeli cultural activities or their cultural exports and play, and what role does the Israeli academy play in maintaining the occupation and oppression of the Palestinians?
It's very true that the first part of the BDS movement to start, and that was in 2004, even before the BDS call came out, was the call for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel. That was not an act of irrationalism on behalf of the Palestinians. It wasn't shooting ourselves in the foot. We knew exactly what we were doing. The Israeli Academy in particular, and I'll talk about the cultural institutions in a moment, but the Israeli Academy, the institutions, the universities, play a central role in planning, justifying, implementing, and whitewashing Israel's crimes against the Palestinian people, Israel's massive violations of international law. They're not just participating. They're not just minor partners. They're a full key partner in crime. So once we launched the call to boycott the Israeli Academy because of its complicity, full complicity with the state in the acts of occupation, colonization, and apartheid, we were hitting a very sensitive nerve, a very raw nerve in Israel. Israel prides itself of its academy, and it likes to think or to project a false image of its academy as liberal, democratic, and at the forefront of the fight for ending occupation and for Palestinian rights. This is a myth propagated by the so-called Zionist left, so-called Zionist liberals, which is an oxymoron, because Zionists, by the very definition of the term, must be racist, because they believe in the chosenness of the Jewish, so-called Jewish people, and against Palestinian rights. They view the Palestinians as lesser humans that are not entitled to equal rights in their indigenous land. Regardless, those liberal Zionists have propagated this false image of the Israeli academy, and it just contradicts completely facts on the ground. I'll just give very quick examples. I can go on. Tel Aviv University has played an extremely central role in developing the so-called Dahiya doctrine, or the disproportionate force doctrine. It's an army doctrine used by the Israeli army after the Lebanon War of 2006 to strike Gaza in its war of aggression and the massacre in Gaza. What this doctrine says is that since Israel cannot practically defeat irregular armies such as Hezbollah, Hamas, and so on, the best, most effective way to crush this type of resistance is by massively punishing the civilian population, destroying civilian infrastructure, and making civilians do Israel's bidding by acting, you know, in proxy, acting to stop the resistance, to avoid the massive price they're paying. So this is exactly what Israel did, and this is what the Goldstone Report has exposed. Israel committed massive war crimes and crimes against humanity, even in Gaza in 2008, 2009, as it did in Lebanon in 2006. Tel Aviv University played the central role in developing this doctrine, so it is absolutely complicit in that crime. And one day, when we are powerful enough to have our own Nuremberg trials of Israeli war criminals and their partners in crime, certainly many heads of Israeli academic institutions and scientists will stand in those cages accused of war crimes. As far as, I'll just give another quick example. The Hebrew University is not just justifying Israeli war crimes. It itself is committing war crimes. How so? One of the two campuses of the Hebrew University, the Mount Scopus campus, sits almost entirely on occupied Palestinian land in East Jerusalem. Transferring settlers from the occupying power to the occupied land is a direct violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention and therefore a war crime. And the Hebrew University is doing that. So the academy in Israel is not just playing a minor role in justifying or making things look nicer. They're very much partners in crime. And I can go on and on. As far as the cultural institutions in Israel, they don't fare any better. I'll just give a quick example. After Israel's massacre in 2009 in Gaza, it sent Bat Sheva, the most famous Israeli dance company, to tour the U.S. Now, that tour was timed right after the massacre in Gaza, which triggered many protests in the U.S., Adala New York, the U.S. campaign for the academic cultural boycott of Israel, and many, many other groups in Minnesota and elsewhere, in Seattle and so on, protested against the Israeli dance company. It was so clear this dance company was sent by Israeli official money to cover up, to whitewash Israel's crimes freshly committed in Gaza. These are not cultural groups. They become ambassadors of a racist criminal state. They're partners in crime, therefore. So they cannot be dealt with as simply dancing, as a dancing company or a music orchestra or a philharmonic and so on. Once they are accepting Israeli state money to cover up, to so-called brand Israel, then they are playing a very political role and playing a very criminal role at that, covering up crimes. So we cannot deal with them as just cultural groups. As a dance choreographer, yes, I do believe that art needs a lot of space, a lot of freedom, but that excludes the freedom to justify or whitewash crimes and violations of international law. This was similar in the South African case. The cultural boycott against the apartheid regime in South Africa, basically called on all artists to boycott performing in South Africa, and called on the world to refuse to invite South African performing artists and groups and so on to the world because they were participating in whitewashing apartheid. One last remark, the Palestinian campaign for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel is institutional in nature. It's not like the South African campaign, which was a blanket boycott against all academics, individuals, and all artists. The Palestinian campaign is simply targeting institutions due to their complicity. And it's not because Israeli academics or artists fare any better than the general public. They're as colonial, as racist as anyone else. On average, per capita, you'll find the same level of racism. One quick example on that, in 2008, four Jewish Israeli academics started a petition that was sent to all 9,000 Israeli academics calling on the Israeli authorities in the territories, they did not even call them occupied territories, in their territories, to allow passage at checkpoints to Palestinian academics and students to reach their schools and universities. And those four Jewish Israeli professors thought, this is the basic requirement for academic freedom, access to the university, and that every self-respecting academic would sign this petition. In fact, out of 9,000, they only got 407 signatures. So this shows you the level of complicity in the academy. The reason why we are not calling for a boycott of academics as individuals or artists as individuals is because we don't believe in McCarthyist measures. We don't believe in political tests. We don't believe in lists of who's a good Israeli and who's a bad Israeli. We prefer to target the clear-cut complicit institutions.
Well, that's a comprehensive answer, the one that is very important because a lot of people, including Noam Chomsky, have questioned that. And that is actually what happened to South Africa. There have been a number of Israeli academics who have supported the academic boycott. Before we go to the phones, perhaps you could, and you've been traveling around the world recently in Canada, perhaps you can give the listeners some idea of some of the successes that the BDS movement has achieved in Europe and Canada and around the world.
Well, I'll start with the toughest part, the sanctions part in the BDS. We always thought of S at the very end of BDS, not coincidentally, but because it's the most difficult. In the South African anti-apartheid boycott, sanctions was last to come. And as we all remember, Ronald Reagan and Thatcher were the very, very last people on earth to support the fight against apartheid or to drop their support for apartheid when they were forced to by grassroots movements and mobilizations. But I'll start with sanctions because recently we've had quite a few successes. The government of Norway has the third largest pension fund in the world, something like $300 billion or more. They've withdrawn, they've divested from two or three now Israeli companies implicated in Israel's occupation and other violations of Palestinian rights and international law. The pension funds in Sweden have also divested from Israeli companies. Denmark, the government of Spain has rejected an Israeli academic team. They denied them the participation in an international competition on green architecture because the team included academics from Ariel, which is a colony college in the occupied Palestinian territory. So even at a sanctions level, we've had quite a few successes, not to mention Bolivia and Venezuela that withdrew their ambassadors from Tel Aviv and cut diplomatic relations after Israel's attack on Gaza. But as far as BND, the boycott and divestment, that's where we had the most of our achievements. Just very quickly, at the trade union level, and trade unions play a key role in the BDS movement, and they did play a key role in the anti-apartheid, South African anti-apartheid boycott as well. There are three major federations, COSATU in South Africa, the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, and the British Trades Union Congress, which includes the Scottish Trade Union Congress, have all adopted BDS and have implemented it to various levels. Other than large federations, we have unions adopting BDS. In Canada, for example, the Postal Workers Union, Canadian Union of Postal Workers, has adopted BDS, and that's the first North American national union to adopt BDS. QP, which is the Canadian Union of Public Employees in Ontario, has adopted BDS. It was the first in Canada to adopt BDS. In France, Italy, Norway, Spain, and I can go on. There are many, many unions that have adopted BDS. Most recently, after the flotilla attack, dock workers' unions have adopted BDS and actually implemented sanctions against Israeli ships, against offloading or loading Israeli ships. The Swedish Dock Workers Union, for example, right after the flotilla, and heeding calls from Palestinian civil society, and especially a united call by Palestinian trade union federations, adopted a sanction regime against Israeli ships for 6 days. They refused to load or offload Israeli ships. Auckland dock workers, supported by massive community protests, prevented offloading an Israeli ship, a Zim ship, for 24 hours. In Cochin, the fourth largest port in India, there were similar actions against Israeli ships. In Durban, South Africa, and so on. In Durban, actually, the very first action against an Israeli ship was taken as far back as February 2009, when Durban dock workers in the South African Transport Workers Union refused to offload an Israeli ship, triggering the beginning of this movement, which reminds us of the anti-apartheid era, the South African anti-apartheid era. Other than trade unions, we've seen a lot of support, especially after the Gaza massacre, among faith-based communities, among liberal Jewish groups. Jewish Voice for Peace in the U.S., for example, is actually leading one of the major BDS campaigns in the U.S. That pressure against CIA crest to divest from companies implicated in Israel's occupation and human rights violations. JVP has not yet adopted BDS, but it's actually leading a BDS campaign that's extremely important for us, and the BDS National Committee, the Palestinian large coalition leading the global BDS movement, has welcomed and fully endorsed the TIAA CREF campaign led by JVP and endorsed by the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, Adala New York, and others. And of course, in California now, there's a major drive to divest the pension funds of the state of California from companies implicated in international law violations in Israel. There's a long list of achievements in the world civil society. In the Arab world, the boycott against Israel is massive, and that's the default, unlike in the West, so there's hardly any persuasion needed. In South Africa, I think that's the most important, the most interesting country where we have boycott, maybe the UK and South Africa, to be fair, because the UK was the first. In South Africa now, there's very recently, South African Artists Against Israeli Apartheid was launched. And just the name of it gives us tremendous hope that South African artists would get together and boycott Israeli cultural institutions and boycott visits to Israel and so on. It's just extremely inspiring. At the University of Johannesburg, there was a decision by the University Senate to start phasing out relations with Ben-Gurion University, and they put very stringent conditions on continuing that relationship. We hope by April 1st that relationship will collapse, announcing the very first academic boycott of Israel to actually succeed.
That's
so
great.
There are many, many cases I can go on.
I had mentioned before the California Initiative. Let's go to a caller here. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. First, could you restate what PDS stands for? As far as the letters and the words?
It's Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions.
Okay, and I'd also like to know how Palestinians regard Rachel Corrie, who was bulldozed in her stance against the homes being destroyed on the West Bank, and also Tristan Anderson, who was literally defaced, was blinded and brain damaged by a tear gas canister when he was doing a similar protest, and what the status, if you know, of their cases as far as remuneration to Tristan Anderson and Rachel Corrie's family and their losses. Thank you very much for what you do.
Thank you for the caller. Did you hear the question?
No, I could hardly hear it.
Oh, he was asking, sorry, that's too bad, but he was asking about, he brought up the case of Rachel Corrie, who was run over, murdered by an Israeli bulldozer, and also Tristan Anderson, who was shot in the face with a tear gas canister. He was wondering if you knew anything about those cases. and if they were supported by the Palestinians in Gaza.
Of course, the Palestinians regard People in Solidarity as part of our movement for freedom, justice, and upholding human rights and international law. Rachel Corrie is considered by all Palestinians as a martyr of the Palestinian liberation movement. We take the heritage of Rachel Corrie very seriously. There are many streets now in Palestine, in the occupied Palestinian territory, called Rachel Corrie Streets. Her story, her courage, her inspiration is now taught at schools, and school teachers bring her case up to explain something about humanity, about standing up to injustice, about speaking truth to power, and so on. So we take to heart the enormous sacrifices given by Anderson, by Corrie, and many, many others, Westerners and others who stood in solidarity with Palestine, especially after the massacre of Gaza.
We have the board lit up here. Let's go to another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I would like your guest to explain exactly his understanding of how Zionism is equated with racism, that the return of a people to a homeland is racist. The question, of course, of the injustice and the cruelty of how that is manifesting is one different aspect, but the racism itself of the return of a people to a homeland does not seem to me to fit into that category. So I would appreciate his understanding on that.
Okay, thank you, caller. Do you hear the question?
No. Connection is really bad. I can hardly hear anything.
Oh, what the caller was saying is he was asking about linking Zionism with racism. He was saying, despite what happened with the Palestinians, how could the return of a people, presumably the Jewish people, to their homeland be considered racist?
It is not that. Maybe the caller misunderstood what I said. The Zionist movement, I'm talking about political Zionism, because there's religious Zionism and cultural Zionism and other aspects of Zionism that I do not want to get into. What concerns us mainly is political Zionism, which is now called the Zionist movement, that supports the State of Israel and its settler colonial regime against the Palestinians. What the Zionist, maybe the Zionist slogan can bring this home, land without a people, to a people without a land, which has so many mistakes in it. There's so many errors. Palestine was never a land without a people. Counting the indigenous as non-existent is the epitome of racism. It reminds us of white colonists taking over the what's now the United States, what was Canada, and so on, and saying that those were empty lands, massacring the indigenous and calling them empty lands. Of course, they've become empty after you've killed off all the indigenous, or most of the indigenous people in those lands, in Latin America and so on. In Palestine, it was driving them out, ethnically cleansing them, forcible removal, rather than a full genocide. So there were massacres and so on. But the racism is the same. It's viewing the indigenous as a lesser human or a non-human, a pest, a fly, an insect, something to get rid of, that's a nuisance, that's standing in your way to colonize, to make this land white and so on, and European and so on. So it's the very same root of racist nationalism that existed in Europe, and that's the root of Zionism. It's not my opinion. I remind the caller that in 1975, the UN adopted a resolution that equated Zionism to racism. It was only cancelled by political agreements, maneuvering, and very heavy pressure from the U.S. after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the start of the so-called peace process. But the world decided that Zionism was a form of racism. Many, many academics have gone into that, so there is no time to go over the details.
We have a couple more.
Now, the most important point is that Israel is still practicing racism every single day, denying the indigenous Palestinians their rights. And that is the core of the problem.
Exactly. Well, let's go to another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. I was calling to see if your guest had heard of Norman Finkelstein.
She wanted to know if you've heard of Norman Finkelstein, of course.
Yes.
Sorry?
Yes?
Yes, he has.
I was going to say that. Sorry, Jeff, can you repeat that?
I'm sorry?
I didn't hear you.
Oh, she just wanted to know if you've heard of Norman Finkelstein. There's a problem caller with Omar hearing the question, so if you make it brief, I'll pass it on.
Okay, but I just wanted to say that anyone that wants to really know what's going on should watch American Radical. It's a DVD, and it's a documentary, and also read his book, The Holocaust Industry. And he is the survivor of Holocaust. His parents were in the Holocaust. And anyway, okay. Thank you for your program.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, caller. Hello, we have time for one more call. Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I just thought I'd mention that I have those forms that are supposed to be going on the ballot.
Yes.
And if anybody would like to sign them or they would like forms, they could contact me. I'd be happy to get them to them.
And
so my name is... I'm sorry?
And your name?
My name is Rick Child. Yeah. I live on the coast, and I'd be happy to help anybody that would like to, you know, sign this divestment form. And the easiest way is if they would just give me a call at 964-1722.
964-1722. Thank you very much for calling, Rick. Glad you got in. Okay, Omar, we're coming down to the end of the hour. I want to thank you very much for an enlightening report on the BDS struggle, the struggle for Palestinian justice. And
thank you, Jeff.
And all the best to you. And I hope to talk to you again and hope to see you again. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Omar Barghouti. My guest speaking from Occupied Palestine. Next week, I will be back here again with Gareth Porter. We'll be talking about the implications of WikiLeaks, not the case of Assange, but actually what the cables mean.